I invite you to join me in the response of invocation, which is in your order of service. We gather to seek, to find, and to share the promise of honest religion. And so it is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. Vulnerability more powerful than strength.
And a peace that can pass all understanding.
It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin together in song. I invite you to join me now in a time of prayer. Spirit of this community in which we find strength and common purpose, we turn our minds and hearts towards one another, seeking to bring into a circle of concern all who need our love and support. Those who are ill, those who are in pain, whether in body or spirit, those who are lonely, those who have been wronged. Our thoughts go to those living life of hardships throughout the world. We think especially today of our neighbours on the Texas coast and the Caribbean islands who have suffered in the recent hurricane. May they all find strength to rebuild their lives. We think of all in the world who live with violence as part of their everyday life. We pray they may find peace soon. We are part of a web of life that makes us one with all humanity, one with all the universe. We are grateful for that miracle of consciousness which we share, the consciousness that gives us the power to remember, to forgive, to change, to cry, to love, to learn, to hope, to care, to heal. May we all find healing and hope at this time. Amen.
The reading today is by Jesus Colon, entitled, Little Things Are Big. I've been thinking, you know, sometimes one thing happens to change your life, how you look at things, how you look at yourself. I remember one particular event. It was when, 1955 or 56, a long time ago. Anyway, I had been working at night. I wrote for the newspaper, and you know, we had deadlines. It was late, after midnight, on the night before Memorial Day. I had to catch the train back to Brooklyn, the West Side IRT. This lady got on the subway at 34th and Penn Station, a nice-looking white lady in her early 20s. Somehow, she managed to push herself in with a baby on her right arm and a big suitcase in her left hand. Two children, a boy and a girl about 3 and 5 years old, trailed after her. Anyway, at Nevin Street, I saw her preparing to get off at the next station, Atlantic Avenue. That's where I was getting off, too. It was going to be a problem for her to get off. Two small children, a baby in her arm, and a suitcase in her hand. And there I was, also preparing to get off at Atlantic Avenue. I couldn't help but imagine the steep, long concrete stairs going down to the Long Island Railroad and up the street. Should I offer my help? Should I take care of the girl and boy? Take them by their hands until they reach the end of that steep, long concrete stairs? Courtesy is important to us Puerto Ricans. And here I was, hours past midnight, and the white lady with the baby in her arm, a suitcase, and two white children badly needing someone to help her. I remember thinking, I'm a dark-skinned Puerto Rican. Suppose I approach this white lady in this deserted subway station late at night. What would she say? What would be the first reaction of this white American woman? Would she say, yes, of course you may help me? Or would she think I was trying to get too familiar? Or would she think worse? What do I do if she screamed when I went to offer my help? I hesitated. And then I pushed by her like I saw nothing, as if I were insensitive to her needs. I was like a rude animal walking on two legs, just moving on, half running along the long subway platform, leaving the children and the suitcase and the woman with the baby in her arms. I ran up the steps of that long concrete stairs in twos, and when I reached the street, the cold air slapped my warm face. Perhaps the lady was not prejudiced after all. If you were not that prejudiced, I failed you, dear lady. If you were not that prejudiced, I failed you. I failed you too, children. I failed myself. I buried my courtesy early on Memorial Day morning. So here's the promise I made to myself back then. If I am ever faced with an occasion like that again, I'm going to offer my help, regardless of how the offer is going to be received. Then I will have my courtesy with me again.
Our invocation at the beginning of service states this is a time for questions more profound than answers. Good questions can help expand our worldview and give us insights into the human condition. Not so profound questions can also provide insights, usually into the condition of the questioner. A couple of years ago, I was asked, why was I born in Scotland? I was confused by the question too, and after some thought, I answered, well, I was young at the time and I wanted to be close to my mother. Maybe this is a good example of the question being more profound than the answer. I find it strange to be asked about an attribute of mine over which I had no control over. Having responsibility for our actions assumes we have some control over them. Not really the case with my own birth. Yet through the use of stereotypes, we often make assumptions of others based on factors that they have no control over, such as gender, country of origin, cultural background, race, or class. I think my questioner was trying to gain some understanding of my country of origin, an area with which he really had no familiarity. I sympathise. I sometimes struggle to relate to people from different cultural backgrounds and fall back on stereotypes to develop some sort of form of communication with them. One author says one reason for stereotypes is the lack of personal and concrete familiarity that individuals have with persons of different racial and ethnic backgrounds. Lack of familiarity encourages the lumping together of unknown individuals. Stereotypes can be useful, but limiting as a way of relating to people different from us. Useful in allowing us to categorise and organise many people we meet every day, but limiting in the generalisations and projections that we make onto those people. Generalisations become most problematic when we make judgments or form values based on them. I sometimes feel that people are like icebergs. You know, there's the 10% above the water, with what way we really know the person from the encounter, and the other 90% we kind of make up and project onto the person based on stereotypes of the person reminds us of, or people that remind us of that person. Stereotyping attempts to assume everyone within a particular group. is similar because of one common attribute, such as colour of skin, primary language spoken, or financial well-being. Such oversimplifications fail to capture the complexity of the individuals, but stereotypes are not about the truth. They play into our conscious and unconscious prejudices, often simplifying what are really complex relationships and resulting in uninformed judgments of others. It is convenient for us to make decisions based on stereotypes because they help us generalise about groups we know little about. Once we have a stereotype of a person or group, then we can find examples from that person that reinforces the stereotype, and then it becomes our truth. This makes it hard for us to change our minds about people and also makes it hard for us to recognise changes that occur in other people. We resist letting the facts get in the way of our opinions, and we constrain others by a generalised image of them. Yet, if we really seek the truth, then we must be open to change our views. A great promise of liberal religion is the ability to change as our understanding widens and our knowledge deepens. Our beliefs are open to change, and the truth we seek is really just the best worldview we have at this present time and will be enriched by our experience in the world. But stereotypes are created for a reason. I believe the purpose of many stereotypes is to justify the privileged status of an insider group, based on a common attribute, and stigmatise the outsider group as somehow responsible for their own lesser status. The most marginalised in our society because of poverty, colour of skin, gender or sexuality are most likely to have their individuality and identity limited or distorted by a group identity. Stereotypes of marginalised groups arise to justify their lower status in society, with the reason for their lower status somehow being that group's own fault. For example, the poor are poor because of laziness and the desire not to work, rather than the other reasons such as prejudice, simple misfortune, or an unfair economic system. I remember getting a rude awakening to my own stereotyping of others while serving breakfast at the homeless shelter at the San Francisco Unitarian Universalist Church. I noticed a number of men were wearing work uniforms, some of them from very well-known companies. I was surprised by this. In closer observation of other men, I noticed they were grooming themselves and rushing out the shelter, much like we do when we're rushing or late for work. Many of these homeless men had jobs. I realised that my stereotyping was that homelessness was synonymous with unemployment. For some, being homeless is synonymous with joblessness. For many, it is not. I wonder if the workmates of the working homeless were aware of the status of their colleagues, or was that just part of the 90% that's hidden from us with relationships with others? This type of disconnection and separation between people goes against what I see as the core of liberal religion. Liberal religion strives for greater inclusion and connection between all people while recognising the contribution each individual makes to the fabric of our religious community. Each individual life contributes a unique story, and difference between our story and that of others helps us grow in our understanding of the human condition in all of its complexity. I believe that diversity of religious thought and a variety of life experience is a source of spiritual growth for us. We learn much more from our differences than our similarities, yet our differences can also separate us from each other. The tension between difference both being a source of growth and a source of separation is a struggle for us in liberal religion. In the reading that Jim read earlier, we heard the author, Jesus Colon, struggle with whether he should help the woman with the children. He knew what the right thing to do was, to help her, but was concerned about how it would be perceived for a black-skinned Puerto Rican man to help a white woman in a subway station late at night. He was aware of the potential prejudices the woman could have, prejudices based on the stereotypes of that day. Would she think he was being too familiar or threatening her? Would her children be frightened of him? The author, Jesus Colon, chose not to help her and says, "I failed myself. I buried my courtesy early on Memorial Day morning." I believe he felt through his own actions and human separation he had lost an important part of his own humanity. There is such a broken human connection when one is fearful even of offering help, not asking for directions or casual conversation or even asking for money, but just asking for help to someone he perceived needed it. He resolves next time he will do what is right regardless of how it is perceived. Jesus' experience occurred in the mid-1950s, yet much of what he says resonates with me today. I know that I often second-guess my own behaviour because of how it will be perceived by others, particularly people of a different gender, age, race, or cultural background. A childhood female friend of mine said to me many years ago, "Brian, you have to realise you're intimidating because of your height. Of course, you're only intimidating until you open your mouth and start to talk." I guess there'll be no fire and brimstone sermons from this preacher today. It's a pity. I remember being quite shocked when she told me about how I could be intimidating, and that self-awareness has stayed with me. That perception of myself affects the way I interact with others. I would imagine most of us here today can think of characteristics of ourselves that we are aware of when we interact with others. Some aspects become more dominant when we are dealing with those different from us, often gender, race, class, or power differentials between people can change how people perceive themselves and the other. I became most aware of how those from marginalised groups can perceive of themselves in stereotypical and limited ways by another experience at the San Francisco Unitarian Universalist Church. I met Nathan Sistone on his first day visiting the San Francisco Church. I was the first person who spoke to him, and we talked for about half an hour. I must have been in good behaviour or very quiet because he returned regularly to the San Francisco Church. And he actually became very involved in our religious community. Nathan and I became close friends. He was bright, funny, and kind-hearted. Prior to knowing Nathan, I had no friends who were transgender. Occasionally, we would discuss his struggles as a person who is transgender and how he had become estranged from his parents 4 years previously as he struggled to accept Nathan's desire for others to recognize him as a man. Nathan found a welcoming home at our church and was popular with many. One day I approached him about becoming a worship associate to co-lead worship services. He resisted, asking, "You think people would be okay having a transgender person leading worship, or do you have an ulterior motive in asking me because I'm transgender?" I understood his concern and replied, "I'm asking you because I think you are bright and articulate. I do have an ulterior motive. I'm 41 years old and do not want to be the youngest worship associate anymore. So I want a 26-year-old like yourself." Nathan's hearty laughter quickly subsided into tears. I was confused and asked him what was wrong. Still sobbing, he explained, "Nothing is wrong. That is what I love about this religious community. People see me as a whole person. Sometimes I need to be reminded of my own complete humanity." This was a revelation for me, to see how one marginalized aspect of someone's identity came to dominate their own view of themselves. We often need to be reminded by others of our own worthiness and wholeness as people, regardless of some specific identity. I think this was Jesus' Colón struggle in the earlier story. He could not see past his identity as a black Puerto Rican. This is understandable given the history of racism and persecution of Puerto Ricans and blacks who have experienced prejudice in our society. This sensitivity to one's own identity was probably a healthy self-preservation mechanism, but as demonstrated in the story, so limiting to human connection. My friend Nathan was fortunate in finding a community that could help him find wholeness as a person and allow him to embrace his full humanity. Some of us here today, I would imagine, feel the same about this religious community in Austin. The San Francisco Unitarian Universalist community was also blessed and transformed by Nathan, his humanity and his compassion. This became all too sadly clear for me about 6 months after the conversation I just discussed. On September 28, 2004, at the age of 27, Nathan died in a car accident. This occurred a week after he and his mother had re-established relationship after several years of estrangement. The Sunday after Nathan's death, he was supposed to give a reflection at the worship service. The minister asked me and two other friends to read his reflection during the service. There was a sense of disbelief amongst everyone present. Despite the solemnity of the occasion, we could not suppress the optimism of his words. It was a difficult and profound experience. I left the service sad but uplifted by the community support and Nathan's optimistic outlook, despite the adversity he had faced in his own life. After the service, I read the newspaper report of his death. I remember feeling my heart sink as the last sentence of the article said the coroner had identified Nathan as a woman. I was angry that even in death, his desire to be who he wanted to be, who he believed he was, being denied. My relationship with and affection for Nathan was so strong that I was hurt by the denial of his identity. This shows me the transcendent power of a relationship where people can bring all aspects of their full humanity, their differences, and their uniqueness into that relationship. This is transforming to all involved, both individuals and community. I know it was true for me, and believe it was true for Nathan and the San Francisco community. And I think this shows the great promise of liberal religion, which is drive towards inclusiveness, and not only acceptance, but an embracing of people's different identity. At our best, we enable all members of our community to embrace their fuller humanity, beyond restrictive stereotypes and prejudices common in our society. Our religious community benefits from a diverse range of experiences and identities people bring into our community. I know my relationship with Nathan forever changed my understanding of and compassion for people who are transgender or struggling with their own gender identity. Historically, both the Unitarian and Universalist movements have sought greater inclusion of people in all aspects of the movement. Women in many religious denominations have had a major role in lay leadership, and that continues today. But that is not true of ordained leadership. Universalist Olympia Brown was the first woman ordained in ministry in North America, and this happened in 1863. In the late 19th century, Unitarians had ordained 23 women. During much of the 20th century, leadership in the Unitarian movement actively blocked and discouraged women from ordained ministry. After the merger of the Unitarians and the Universalists, only 2% of our ministers were women as late as 1970. Reflecting the greater equality women have elsewhere in our society, Today, there are more women actively serving as Unitarian Universalist ministers than men. So if you want a stereotype of a Unitarian Universalist woman, Unitarian Universalist minister, it would be a woman, not a man. I believe that the struggles women have for greater equality can only enrich the ministries within our movement. While women ministers may be common in Unitarian Universalism, we should not forget that many religious movements in the United States, women are a small minority or not allowed in ordained leadership. Another example of a liberal religious drive for inclusion with the Unitarian Universalist movement has been the acceptance and support of gays and lesbians. This includes many openly gay ministers serving without controversy, in contrast to other denominations. Yet, I still feel there's work for us to do in this area. I was very surprised to read a recent survey of a Unitarian Universalist church in the San Francisco Bay Area where 25% of the congregation said they might not be happy with a gay minister. This situation gets further complicated when one considers the same congregation 1 year later called a gay minister with a 94% vote in favour. In thinking about these two contradicting facts, I wonder if there's some stereotype of a gay minister at work here such that 25% of a congregation felt troubled by the idea. When a gay minister was proposed as the minister for the church, people were able to see the individual beyond any gay stereotype. While this sounds a hopeful example of transcending stereotypes, I wonder if a different ministerial candidate could overcome the same prejudice. This suggests to me we still have work to break down stereotypes. I can't imagine 25% of a congregation saying they would be concerned about hiring a heterosexual minister. This shows the struggle we have with stereotypes. When a person comes from a group familiar with a group we're familiar with or we perceive like ourselves, then we see them more as an individual. But I suspect we still project much of our own values onto them. When a person comes from a group we perceive to be different from ourselves, then we are much more likely to stereotype an individual with properties of a group. Properties that have nothing to do with the individuals themselves. This can be a problem since most stereotypes are negative. So how does liberal religion guide us to respond to the limited perspectives demonstrated by stereotypes? I believe our striving for inclusion of people with differing beliefs and life experience is fundamental to overcoming the prejudices of stereotypes. One of the defining characteristics of liberal religion is that we are non-creedal, where we do not have to profess shared belief to be part of this community. This allows an openness of religious and personal expression within our communities and creates a place where through honest and open interaction, spiritual growth of individuals and our community can occur. Our differences are a strength. Similarity leads to conformity, conformity of religious views, conformity of societal norms, conformity of a patriarchal culture, conformity of political orthodoxy, and conformity of what it means to be human and fully alive. The difference that comes from a diversity of opinions, histories, cultural backgrounds, class, gender, and race lead us to wrestle with questions that are more profound than the answers. A seeking that helps us to grow our soul a little each time we struggle to live to our highest ideals. In serving our highest ideals, we seek to understand the struggles of those who are different from us. In serving our highest ideals, we seek to overcome our own biases and prejudices as we honestly encounter the individuality of others. In serving our highest ideals, we accept that we are capable of great service to others, even as we are imperfect in our relationships with them. The encounter with difference is the great promise of liberal religion. Our honest and humble and compassionate response to this encounter helps us to transcend the stereotypes of others and ourselves. In doing so, we connect more fully with our own humanity and the humanity of others. This, I believe, is how best we can bless the world. I believe Jesus Colon connected with himself in the story we heard earlier when he promised to help, offer his help regardless of how it was perceived. I believe my friend Nathan connected with his wholeness as a person when he realized others viewed him as more than a person who was transgender. I believe I am most complete and whole when I am serving others in the cause of higher ideals. I leave you with this question. When do you feel most alive and whole as a person? When we live in our action, the answer to that question, we are blessing and enriching our world.